we can go ahead and get started. If you guys are okay with it, I'm just going to sit because otherwise I'm going to be balancing my laptop on the corner, and I feel like that would be worse than sitting. And we're a really small group, so I don't feel like I need to stand and present. And because we're a small group, this can be a really, like, I have a lot prepared because these are topics I care about and know about, but we can definitely kind of break from format to make it this be an hour that is a better fit for you guys and your families and what you need. So the overall focus is on ADHD and ASD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and autism spectrum disorder, but really anything within those developmental disability framework, if that's what's going on for you guys, then we can absolutely kind of bring that into the conversation. Hello, welcome. So a little bit about me before we get started. So my name is Hannah Longenecker. I am currently a doctoral student. I will graduate in August of this year with my doctorate in clinical psych. So this is me. When I was a kid, I was homeschooled K through 12. So my mom is one of the other speakers today. I was told that she had introduced me today. I wasn't aware that they were doing introductions, so I apologize. I wasn't here to introduce myself. And so I was homeschooled K through 12, and then I am a student at Wheaton College, and I'm currently on my internship, so I have everything done. I just have to defend my dissertation, and then I'll finish my internship, which is at WellSpan Philhaven. So one day a week, I'm in Ephrata, doing outpatient therapy with kids, families, and adults, and then like 3 to 4 days a week, I'm on the child adolescent inpatient unit doing therapy and assessment. With kids and adolescents who are there for psychiatric hospitalization. I just always have to throw in, so this is my husband, Ashton. So we met in graduate school. He is from Seattle, but ironically was also homeschooled, him and his 7 siblings. So he's 1 of 8, which was an adventure coming from a family of 3, and getting married into a family of 8 was definitely a difference, but it's been really fun. So that's kind of my personal background and why I really enjoy talking to homeschooling parents about these things. And then professionally, I really focus on assessment with children and adolescents throughout my graduate training. And it's something that I have really enjoyed, and I have had a lot of experience both with ADHD and autism, both in therapy and assessment, and then also going forward with other developmental difficulties, including fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. So a brief overview of what we can talk about today. So I'll kind of go briefly through like ADHD and ASD, because everybody, as I'm sure, is coming in here from different perspectives. Some of you might be at the point of like, hey, like we're noticing some things, and like some of our kids have stuff going on that we're not really sure what it's about, and could it fit into these categories, and could this be a helpful understanding and conceptualization of what's going on for our kiddos. And for some of you, it might be like, yeah, we kind of know all of this. We're like, we really are just like, okay, what do we do with these conceptualizations? So I'll try to kind of hit both. So there'll be parts that might feel more relevant to some and some that will feel more relevant to others. Really talk about the difference and the overlap between these diagnoses, because it can be really complex. And in our understanding, what can we do about it? And I'll try to make sure that we have at least 15 minutes at the end for questions. And even if you don't have kind of questions you want to share with the whole group, we can absolutely kind of, I'll try to hang out for a while afterwards so that we can talk if that feels better for you guys. So I'll just go ahead and jump right in. So I'll talk about kind of ADHD, how we think about that, autism, how we're thinking about that currently, and then go into the next pieces. So ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. There are a lot of questions that I found in my work with parents and with kids and with adolescents. like one of the biggest is like, what's the difference between ADHD and ADD? Like, medical providers and therapists and all these people will throw around these terms, and it's like, but what do they mean? Like, I don't quite get it. I get asked a lot about like defiance. Like, okay, so is my kid just being defiant, or like, are they? Is the symptomology or these symptoms? Like, what exactly is going on? And then another one that I get asked all the time, so it's like, so my kid like loves video games and they can play Minecraft for hours and hours and hours and hours and they have no problem paying attention to that, but like I ask them to do one math problem and it's like they can't look at the page for more than a second. Oh yeah, go for it. It was open when I came up, so I wasn't sure if that's how it was supposed to be. And just for the people who came a little later, I absolutely can stand up if that feels better. There just wasn't a table, and I felt like because it was a smaller room, it felt a little bit too impersonal. But if anyone can't see or can't hear me, just let me know, and I can stand up. So how we're thinking about ADHD currently, so we have the predominantly inattentive presentation, predominantly hyperactive presentation, then combined presentation, and then I'll go into the symptoms that can kind of fit within those categories. So to answer that first common question, so ADD is not something that is clinically diagnosable anymore, so it used to be absolutely, but then in 1987 the language switched and it moved, so ADD is kind of encompassed under the umbrella of ADHD. So that's that predominantly inattentive presentation is what would have been known as ADD in previous language. One of the big things with defiance and ADHD is like there's this expectation for kiddos who have struggles in these areas to do things that are hard for them, and that just like on a brain level it is harder for them than other kiddos. And there are things that might be relatively easy for other kids, like depending on if you have kiddos who have struggles in this area and then have kiddos that don't have struggles in this area, you might find, you know, like this kid, like I can say go do your homework or like go do math, and they just sit down and they do it, and it's like maybe they need you to come help, and you no, that's awesome. Water is very important. I love the excitement. So you see that difference. It's like, okay, like I'm just asking, like I'm not asking you to like, you know, do calculus. Like I just want you to sit down and do addition. I know you can do this. Or maybe you're saying like, okay, it's time to like stop playing your game. It's time to come and wash your hands and get ready for dinner. And it just becomes this war zone of like, how, like absolutely not. How could you ask me to do that? And it's part of that is because it really does challenge a lot of the areas that we'll talk about in the next slide. So like paying attention, they have to tolerate boredom, they have to control their activity levels and control the impulses of like, okay, I'm sitting at the kitchen table, but I see that cookie on the counter and like that sounds like more fun, so maybe I should go over there and look at that instead. And oh, there's that toy that's I know is on that shelf over there that I saw like 10 minutes ago, so maybe I should go do that instead of sitting here at the table doing what mom told me to do 2 seconds ago. And the last one, which is one of, I think, the things I hear most, like I said, is that, okay, question of, so like, they can attend to this thing that they love, but then they can't pay attention to anything that I tell them. So like, what's going on? Are they choosing this? Are they not choosing this? And something that I found really helpful in understanding these kiddos is that ADHD really is a disorder of controlling and directing attention. So it's really, so when they're paying attention to something that they love, like they're not actually using the processes that make like other things difficult, because they're not, it's not really hard. Like, oh, like video games, super rewarding. Like, okay, I get to do this and then this and then this and then this. Or even like if you have a kiddo that loves reading and they love reading like very specific kinds of stories, like maybe they really like adventure stories. It's like, okay, so the story keeps going and it's feeding me and it's keeping me engaged. So I'm not really using attention in the same way, whereas if like maybe I have to read that classic book that mom told me to read, like, and that takes all of my attention and like that just feels overwhelming. So it's not as much as like, okay, I'm choosing to like really attend to this and then I'm just choosing not to attend to this. It really is the brain, their brains are working differently and there are different things being activated for those situations. So really briefly, I'll go through just some of the symptoms because I know this might be familiar to a lot of people. So here are all of the inattentive symptoms. And for to have a diagnosis of either ADHD predominantly inattentive or ADHD combined, 6 or more of these would need to be present. So things like struggling to pay attention or like making careless mistakes. So like maybe your kid, like, you know, they get math, but like, wow, they forget like the negative signs in front of their numbers all the time. And like they'll add instead of subtract, but like, you know that like, the answers should be right, but like they just are making a lot of these little mistakes, or they keep forgetting commas when you know they know how commas work. Difficulty sustaining attention, so not getting distracted. Like difficulty listening when spoken to directly, so like just not really kind of computing what's being said to them. Organization is a huge thing. So in older kids, we see this a lot in like essay writing, just thinking about like the academic way. So you can think about if you struggle to organize things, it's really hard to think, okay, so like this is the point I'm trying to make, and like these are the points beneath it, and this is how it has to end. That structure is really difficult for them to create for themselves. Losing things is a big thing, being easily distracted by the world, and then frequently forgetting things. And then the hyperactivity, so it's the same thing, 6 symptoms that are for either the predominantly hyperactive, or you would need 6 of this and 6 of inattentive or more for the combined. So these are the symptoms that we think more kind of typically with ADHD, and this is the stuff that if you have a kiddo kind of in this realm that you probably noticed pretty young that something was going on. Like these are the kiddos that it's a lot harder to miss in many ways, which really in a lot of ways does them a disservice because they're the ones that kind of get pinpointed at a lot younger age, because what they're struggling with is a lot more visible. So like a lot of fidgeting and squirming, getting up when they're expected to stay seated, like feeling like they're always on a go, like constantly like blurting out answers. Like you can think of kids in Sunday school, if you like, you hear from Sunday school teachers and being like, you know, like your kid is really engaged, but like they just like every time we ask a question, like the question's not even out of our mouth, and they're like, and this is the answer. And it might be right, it probably is, but like just the impulse control and the waiting is really hard, like interrupting and intruding. Like these are the kids that more so than their siblings are going to be like, when you're on the phone, like, mom, and then just keep going, and just like not even really have that awareness of like, oh, like this is like mom's talking to somebody else or dad's talking to somebody else, maybe I should wait until she's ready and then she'll respond to me. So that's kind of that overview of ADHD, especially if you're coming in and it's kind of like, okay, we're having some questions about our kiddos. Like these are the things we start to think of if we're seeing, or like, okay, maybe there's something related to ADHD or another neurodevelopmental difficulty going on. And then the next thing we'll touch in on briefly, again, trying to fly through this piece. I've given this talk once before and I spent way too much time on this and then we missed out on all the good stuff at the end. But if you have any questions, please feel free to stop me. I know I'm going really fast.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Do you have an age window where you start to actually take a diagnosis seriously? Or because kids have a range of learning all these behaviors.
Right.
So what's the age window where you start to kind of dial in and go, yeah, if they're still doing that by this time?
Right. I think it really depends on the kid. And we think of everything, so like, what is developmentally appropriate? So like, if a 3-year-old can't sit for more than 2 minutes, like, we're not really gonna take, like, that's not concerning, that's just being 3. Like, maybe some 3-year-olds can sit for, 10 minutes if they really like something, but if your 3-year-old can only sit for a minute at a time, like, that's okay. But if your 6-year-old, like, can't sit for a minute, like, the typical like that's not as typical. So it's really, we think of things very developmentally, which can make it hard, and it kind of, and the other thing that we think about is it causing impairment? So, like, is, like, maybe your kid, like, really struggles to focus, but they, and, like, maybe that's, like, but, like, they have enough skills around it that at least right now it's not, like, kind of at that level that we could diagnose, or maybe they don't hit those all six symptoms of inattention, or, so I know that's not, like, a specific thing. I would say the youngest I usually, I have ever confidently diagnosed ADHD was, it was exclusively the hyperactive kind, and it was at 5. And it was just very clear that, like, the, like, attention levels were very different than other 5-year-olds. Like, just this kiddo, like, could only do, like, one question of testing at a time, and then we had to, like, get up and play, and we had just had to have so much additional structure and so many, like, reward incentives, like, okay, every question you finish, we're going to get up and go to the whiteboard, and we're going to make a check, and when you get all your checks, then you get to pick something from the prize box, but it, and some, a lot of, that's, a lot of kids need that, because, you know, some of the things we ask them to do are a little bit boring, but they still got to do them. But it's pretty simple, like, okay, we're going to do, like, these 5 things, and then you get a check for each 5, like, each thing, and then at the end. But this kiddo was so much more to the other end of, like, literally everything that you were doing, we're needing to reinforce it.
Just one more.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you, because I've always been on that end. Where
yeah.
That kid is.
Yeah.
He's hyperactive. So how much of it do you take personality tests, like the Myers-Briggs? How much of it do you, like, when you're diagnosing, how much of the actual personality style
Right.
do you play into that and, like, figure out, oh, well, that's just part of his...
His approach, or the kiddos.
Yeah.
So there aren't really good personality tests for kids.
Yeah.
And, like, even the Myers-Briggs, like, from, it's really helpful on, like, an organizational level, but on a, like, validity, like, in testing, we look a lot at, like, the validity and reliability of the test. So, like, is this, do we consistently get the same result? And, like, are we, how confident are we that result is accurate? And the Myers-Briggs just struggles with that because it's not the point of it. The point is to really give interpersonal data because people's, like, the stuff it looks at changes for people. And so the type of personality we do looks a little bit more at kind of underlying personality traits, and we can do that more for, like, you know, 9. Like, I think the youngest we have a really good personality test for is 9. So those little kids, like, they just don't really have enough verbal skills a lot of times to really communicate to us, like, what their underlying personality structure
is. The reason I'm asking
is,
like, I've never been treated for that.
Yeah.
But as an adult, I realized that a lot of my issue was I was hyper creative.
Yeah.
So I was always creating something in my mind, or always, like, envisioning how things work. So my mind would go really fast, so I'd be in a regular classroom, and it'd go too slow for me.
Yeah.
I couldn't really engage because it was just like, this is so boring.
Yeah. Well, and we can talk about this a little bit later too, but something that's really common, it's not super common because, you know, just statistically it's not going to happen for everyone, but what we see a lot of times with what we would call twice exceptional kids, so you have this, like, significant neurodevelopmental struggle paired with, you know, either one area or multiple areas of, like, intellectual strength. Like, that disparity is going to make things harder because in some, you know, if they're in public school, maybe some classes are, like, they need, like, kind of the average, like, okay, we got to go slow. And in some classes, it's just like, okay, like, yeah,
whatever.
Like,
because of the way their brains work.
Whatever. And I think that especially that's one of the strengths of homeschooling for kids, especially when there are those disparities. Because you can see it, like, I saw it with one of my siblings, who there were some things, like, more on, like, the social-emotional spectrum that were really difficult, and being in the homeschooling environment was helpful, but it also meant that, like, they could kind of do the academic thing at their own pace, which was very fast. It was a sibling of mine, I love telling this story because it was something that played in my mind a lot as a kid, because I wasn't quite like this, but, like, it was my older brother, and he... had struggles in certain areas, but his senior year, he like didn't really do AP Physics at all until 2 weeks before the exam, and like studied for it for 2 weeks and got a 4, which it's a 1. So like, and like compared to me, who like worked like to the 4 I got on one of my AP exams, like I studied all year to get it. Like, so it's just, it's again that difference. And that's one of, I think, the greatest strengths of homeschooling, is that you can really hone in on what is that strength and what is that struggle and how do we match both of those.
Thank you. I just wanted your take on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, and again, any thoughts that you guys have, like, again, I have this material because I've done this talk before and I like talking about it, but I would much rather this be a time that's helpful for you as questions come up than it just you guys just listening to me talk. Like, the point is that this is beneficial, not that you just hear me say things. So for ASD, in 2013, the autism diagnosis changed. So it changed. We had like a lot of like little diagnoses, and then we kind of put them all together and made autism spectrum disorder. And we dissolved the diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, which is a whole other conversation that I have lots of feelings about that we can that we wouldn't have time for today. I'm not the biggest fan, we'll say that. And one of, like, I think the biggest things that I parents ask me, especially coming into like therapy treatment with their kid, is like, okay, like if they have ASD, if we're either thinking about that diagnosis or they've had that diagnosis, like, is this going to harm my child? And like, also, if they have it, how do I talk? Like, should I talk to them about it? That happened to me very recently. A parent came in and like, well, we just got this diagnosis, but our kid is 7, and like, should we even tell them? Like, what's, I don't really know. And I, with that, I've really found that like, there's the concern, and rightfully so, that the label of autism can like, could harm a child, because a lot of people don't get it. Like, what if it'll make her feel weird, or hurt her opportunities to do things, or hurt her self-esteem? But a lot of times the opposite is true, where there can be like kind of a relief in being able to finally have yes, it's a label, but it's also like an understanding of like, oh my gosh, like all of these things that we were kind of like, yeah, but like we'll just deal with it. Yeah, we'll deal with it. Yeah, we'll deal with it. Have an umbrella and have a name, and there it gives us a way forward. And I, from what I've seen, I think that relief extends to the kiddos too, especially when you have a kiddo who has higher functioning, and there's like, and they can kind of feel that difference of like, yeah, like I know I'm like, yeah, I'm not as interested in that, but like there are things that are harder for me that aren't as hard, you know, for the kid down the street, or aren't like, it's the younger, like my younger sibling like has lots of friends, but I don't really have lots of friends, and I don't really know how to make friends, but like I know that I don't have friends, and holding that balance can be really hard. And you know how you're going to talk about autism isn't going to be the same to a 5-year-old as it would be to a 15-year-old, but there are a lot of really good developmentally appropriate ways to kind of say like, this is how we can talk about it. I have a book that I forgot to bring with me. It's at one of my offices. It's called All My Stripes, and it's geared towards kiddos with autism. It's about a zebra who has autism, and he comes home from school and has had a really bad day, and he goes through like all the things that were hard for him, and it kind of hits all the big areas of autism. And then the second half of the book is his mom saying like, yeah, all these things are hard for you, and these are all the things that you do really well because of this. Like, talks about like, you really know maps, so whenever we go anywhere, you know exactly where we are. And like, I never have to worry about you lying, because like you have, and it's kind of like that black and white thinking of autism, but it's also like, good is good and bad is bad, and like, I'm not gonna lie because like, I'm gonna tell the truth.
What's the age level of that book?
I feel like depending on the reading level of the kiddo, you could use it as young as like 4 or 5. I used it with a 7-year-old in session the other day, and he liked it. I think it's also really helpful for parents. Like, I had in session, I had the dad read it to the kiddo, and the kid, because he has autism, was kind of like, yeah, that's not like me. Dad was a little bit like, but like, remember when you do this? Like, that's kind of like what this kid is going through in the book.
They can read it themselves, then, it sounds like.
Yeah, like they could absolutely read it themselves. And I think it's something we do a lot with kiddos in treatment is we'll create social stories of kind of, so because a huge thing with autism is like you're not pulling in the same data from your environment. So like having like a repetitive story that you're told a lot helps you learn, especially younger kiddos, helps you them learn kind of what's going on. Like there is, I had a supervisor who had like a four-year-old kid with pretty significant ASD who was really afraid of babies. Didn't have any siblings, but was like really afraid of babies. And like, so she created a social storybook that was basically like, babies aren't scary. Sometimes babies cry. Sometimes that makes us feel sad. Like, but babies, this is why babies are safe. And they would read it like almost every session to just really reinforce that narrative of like, this is what happens. This is okay. This is like, this is what you're feeling. This is what's happening. And here's how it's going to end. But it's this, I like to think of it the same way, like, a seven-year-old with anxiety. Like, I'm going to explain anxiety to my seven-year-old clients way differently than I'm going to talk about it to my 15-year-olds. Like, with younger kids, I use analogy a lot of, like, sometimes anxiety or other things, like, makes us stuck. And it's like we have a rock brain, and we want to have a rubber band brain where we can kind of flexibly interact with our environment. Now, if I said that to my 15-year-old, they would look at me like I had three heads and was an idiot. So you kind of have to adapt to the level, but like, no matter what the level of the kid, like they have awareness. So real briefly, I'll just go through some of these. So these are kind of the big seven things we look at for autism and ADHD. So the persistent deficits in social communication and interaction. So, and I'll go through these a little bit just because one of the big, I think the big problems and kind of the disconnect between, you know, treatment and families is like, we like to use these like words that like, I've been doing this for 5 years and I still have to like look at the definitions. To like, what exactly does this mean? So social emotional reciprocity really just means like that back and forth. Like, can you engage in like back and forth conversation? Do you show interest in other people? Like, do you, when you're playing, do you hand toys to peers and try to bring them in, or you just like pretend like they're just don't even notice them? Like nonverbal, like, do you notice like there's a disconnect like when your kid says like, I'm really excited, but like there's no facial expression, or they don't really match their body language to what's going on, or like they don't ever really use gestures. And then the relational, like engagement in relationships, like that imaginative, you can think of that as like imaginative play, interest in others, things like that. And then the restricted and repetitive behavior. So we can think of these as like the stereotypes, like motion, movement, objects, speech. So like lining up toys, hand flapping, excessive spinning or rocking, kind of like odd hand posturing, like repetitively copying like a word or a sound that they hear and saying it over and over and over again. Insistence on sameness. So I see this one a lot. So like needing routines to be exactly the same. Or like I come home from school and I go to my room and I do this. And if mom asks me a question on my, the way to my room, I lose it because that's not part of my plan. Restricted or fixated interest. And a lot of times, you know, kids from all ages, especially younger kids, like usually have like one or two things. Like some of my friends' kiddos have loved Thomas the Tank Engine from like the time they, I think they were like 6 months, and I think he's almost four, and I'm pretty sure he still loves Thomas. And like that's normal. Like it's normal for kids to have like one or two things that they really love. But if it never changes and he's seven and his only love is still Thomas, like that's something, that's data. or if it's like a really kind of age inappropriate interest. So like if a five-year-old is super interested in sprinkler systems and how they work and only wants to talk about sprinkler systems, or is really into movie ratings and wants and knows what every movie was rated on Rotten Tomatoes and knows why it's good and why it's bad, but doesn't want to talk about anything else other than movie ratings, that would fall in. And then lastly, hypersensitivity, reactivity to sensory information. So either like really loving loud noises and like wanting to have things crashing all the time, or you can think of it as like being really, like really averse from loud noises. If like anything is like above a whisper or like a low voice, they're like covering their ears because they can't tolerate it. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later, but it's that just because there's sensory concerns, again, doesn't necessarily mean autism, but it just gives us information. Any questions about that? Yes?
Is it possible to have both? Like, I feel like maybe my son's, he just turned 7, and he's my oldest kid, so
right.
We know he's quirky, but it's like, he's looking a whole lot more like he's ADHD
right
now versus like an autism spectrum. Is it like possible to like outgrow autism spectrum?
So if it's truly ASD, you're not going to grow out of it. Depending on the level of kind of developmental impairment, I think it is definitely possible to build enough skills that like it, to anyone on the outside, like you wouldn't really know. Like there might be something that's like, oh, that's like a little off still. Yes.
Right. So let's just get right
at. Yeah.
So she's on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. She's high functioning.
Right.
And with a lot of therapy, she can pull off verbal really well.
Yeah.
Really well.
Yeah.
But then when it hits the fan, it's big.
Right. Absolutely.
So, yeah. So can you? That was going to be my question too. Is you can't outgrow it. It's still there, even though you can appear. Like
right.
It's not.
Because the same level of work is really going into it that it is. So, like, for your kiddo, and I don't know, and we'll kind of go into like how like ADHD and ASD can kind of, they can both be diagnosed together, but that's also like, okay, but they can look really similar, so how do we kind of differentiate between these things? But like, because they're both neurodevelopmental, we wouldn't say like, okay, your brain structure is gonna completely change. But there's also a lot of reasons that they're both like diagnosed incorrectly, depending on who your provider is and all of those great things that are a whole other topic. There's so much on like neurodevelopmental difficulties and how we think about them that we could go into. But there's always like, I think one of the reasons I love talking about these things is they're both diagnoses that are kind of a lot of times talked about like, kind of like a sentence almost, like, and you have ADHD or you have autism, and like, that's just it. And it's like, but that's not true. Like, I see it every day that like, yeah, they have these struggles, but they have strengths, and there are so many ways that they can build skills no matter what level they are. Like, yeah, maybe you have a kid that's nonverbal, but I've seen a lot of kids who are nonverbal who have learned how to use communication boards. And like that's huge skill development because it's huge from where they were to where they're going. So there's lots of hope and things. And I think maybe even talking about the differences might help, because especially around the social piece, I find that a lot of times if that's the main thing going on, that sometimes it is a little bit more ADHD and it gets mislabeled as autism because we don't think about it. Yes.
Like you can have the sensory process. Differences like being very sensitive or being like seeking a lot of like deep hugs and all of that with the ADHD. Like I have some dyslexia, ADHD, and sensory processing, but he's not have autism. So, and it's very noticeable. Like you can definitely see he's fine in social settings. And he doesn't have any like restricted interests or anything, but he's got like all the other stuff.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's a great note, and we'll talk a little bit about like the, even the sensory piece, and I have a great case to talk about. So because of how my laptop is, I can't see the time. Could somebody just let me know? Because I want to make sure we have time for like actual 11:19. Okay, we're doing okay. So for ADHD and ASD, so there are a lot of ways that these can look really similar. They used to not be able to be diagnosed together in 2013. The rules changed. And there are similar symptoms, but they have different reasons for being present. And the big three that I've seen of this, so executive functioning, sensory skill, social skill deficits, and then sensory concerns. And again, we can diagnose them together, and that absolutely happens. But it doesn't always happen, and sometimes we'll lean one way or another if we don't think about the full picture. So executive functions are the higher order brain functions that help each person to effectively organize the world and interact with those around them. So those are like when we talk about that prefrontal cortex that like doesn't really fully form until like the mid-20s, like that's where a lot of that is coming from. And really both ADHD and autism too, in a large way, are disorders of executive functioning. But the pattern of how those are impacted can look really different. So we can even think about something like inhibition as an executive function, like the ability to like inhibit our impulses. That's all executive functioning. And with, you know, kiddos with the hyperactive form of ADHD, their inhibition can really struggle. And it can also struggle for a kiddo with autism, but how that looks might look a little bit different. Whereas the inhibition for ADHD might be a little bit more like all over the place, and maybe with a kiddo with autism it might look all over the place a little bit, but maybe it applies more to certain situations, or like not even like really understanding the social rules in the same way that would say like, okay, this is the rule and now that's why I should inhibit. Other things like sustained attention, so that's the ability to pay attention despite distractions. Working memory, so the capacity to hold information in mind while performing complex tasks. So this is one that we see a lot with ADHD. It's that, like, this is something you use with math and writing, especially, because it's that ability to, like, say, like, okay, I'm holding one and one in my brain together, and then I'm putting them together, and they make two. But I have to kind of keep them in my brain, and they're, like, going around in there. Same way with if I'm writing an essay. Like, I have to know, okay, like, this is my topic, and now I'm writing in this paragraph, but this paragraph has to connect to this topic, so I have to keep in mind the basic point of what I was talking about up here, and then connect it down here, and then keep that going. And for both kiddos with ADHD and autism, that's going to be difficult. So with executive functions, like especially if you have more of an evaluation for a kid, a lot of times different patterns will emerge, and there's not necessarily specific patterns for each, but you're going to see definite deficits, like much more deficits with sustained attention probably. If there is an ADHD diagnosis, and then emotional control, you're probably going to see in both, which is more of that ability to manage emotions to achieve goals or control or direct behavior. So one of my big passions with diagnosis is around social skills, because I feel like this is something that gets missed so much. So both kiddos with ASD and kiddos with ADHD can have pretty significant deficits in social skills. So they're like being aware of the world around them and understanding the rules can be really hard, but the reason is different. So for kiddos with ASD, like they have neurodevelopmental differences in the actual process of intaking social information in the typical way, and there's a difference in that desire for social interaction. It doesn't mean that it can't be built, but like the fundamental desire, depending on the level, is going to be different. Whereas if your kiddo has ADHD, like you're, it's not probably that they don't have a desire for social interaction, it's that they're not able to attend to the information around them, so they're just not, they're not taking it in. So if you think of a kid who can't attend to face it, like if you're not paying attention, you don't know that like my facial expression is telling you things, you don't know that my body language is telling you things, like you don't know that the tone of my voice is telling you things, because you're not, they're not taking in that information in the same way, because they're not slowing down enough to really hear it. So they're one of, I think, the best examples of this. There's a test that we do when we're looking at kind of neurodevelopmental differences in social skills. And there are two tests. And one is you're looking, the kids like look at faces and basically have to match faces that are showing the same emotion together. And a lot of times both kids who end up with diagnoses of ASD or ADHD struggle with that, because they're not used to looking at faces and taking that information and pairing it together and figuring out, like, okay, so like this face means happy, so that goes with this face that's slightly different, but like this means sad and this means fear. But there's another test that we do that looks at theory of mind, which is kind of that ability to perspective take and understand that like other people's worlds don't always have the same view as mine. So like something like, okay, like, if I give, like, we'll ask kids a question, like, okay, if, like, I showed you this box and there's, it has blocks on the box, but I open it, and it actually has pencils in it, it's like, oh, there's pencils, not blocks. Like, and then you close the box again, it's like, if your friend walked into the room and saw this box that they know has pencils in it, what would they think is in the box? And kiddos who struggle with theory of mind are going to say pencils, because they know it has pencils, so whoever they know who comes in should know it has pencils too. And kids who kind of have a typical theory of mind are going to be able to say blocks, because they know that they didn't know it had blocks in it until they opened it, so somebody coming in wouldn't know if the box had, didn't have blocks. So that's something I just would always keep in mind. Again, it doesn't mean that ASD and ADHD can't co-occur. It doesn't mean that one is like better or worse than the other. It just means that I think sometimes that piece is forgotten. It's like, okay, if there's a social struggle, then that means that there's ASD going on. And that's not always the case. Just like if there's attention struggle, it doesn't always mean that it's ADHD. And then the last one is sensory concerns. So sensory differences are common and normative until they're not. So the biggest question is it causing impairment? So I'm sure if we went around this room, we could all share like lots of sensory preferences. Like I really hate mushy foods. I don't like scratchy things. Like I personally have a very long list, but they don't cause me impairment. Like if I need to eat the yogurt because it's going to make me feel better, I'll eat it. Like I can eat, I can kind of can manage my environment. But when they're causing impairment, so I think of a kiddo who's like the big sensory concern mom had was like, well, she won't wear jeans because she doesn't like how they feel. And that was like the really big thing. It's like, okay, but like she wears leggings, she wears lots of other pants, she wears skirts. Like there's a lot of other things that she'll wear. Like now if it was all clothing is bad and I can't tolerate that, then it's like, okay, that's impairment because you can't leave the house if you're naked. Like, though I'm sure we all have kids in our lives who at one point or in the other really thought that that should be an option. And both kids with ASD and ADHD can appear to have really significant sensory difficulties, and it's important to think about the function of these difficulties. So is it hyperactivity or sensory seeking? It doesn't mean that it can't be both, but it does mean that sometimes it's important to think about that. So like I had a case once where like mom had been told like your kid is a sensory seeker, that's all that's going on, like just like let him sensory seek and that'll help. And this was a homeschooling family, so like mom was like letting kid like roll around on her king size bed as they were doing homeschooling, because she was like that's what he needs. And then when we did testing and it was like very comprehensive, we had medical, we had occupational therapy, we had psychological, and all of his sensory systems were intact. Like, his sensory stuff was okay, but he had one of the worst cases of ADHD I've ever tested. Like, just incredibly hyperactive. And he loved the sensory stimulation because he's hyperactive. And it's like, well, this is way more fun. Like, when we did testing with him, like, we have a lot of skills we use with kids to help them learn to calm their bodies and see how that works. And he, like, actively fought against calming his body because he was just like, but this is so much more fun to be up here. And that information was really important to mom to think about, okay, so like something is going on. It's not exactly what we thought it was, but maybe we can kind of tweak how we're doing things, because another part of that was because he was just moving all the time, he wasn't able to really learn. So there was a lot of, especially reading concerns with that kiddo. Again, doesn't mean that the sensory piece is not ever there. It absolutely is. It's just thinking about, okay, like, what exactly is going on and exploring that. So those were some of the differences. Any questions about that piece? Okay. And then kind of the what can we do? So the beauty of having kiddos with ASD and or ADHD, especially in a homeschooling environment, is that there is a lot of power in the environment that you're able to create, which I think about the families that I know who have managed and kind of flourished within these kind of categories. The phrase like daunting and beautiful has come to mind a lot of times, because it's just this incredible responsibility that can feel really overwhelming. And also there's a lot of beauty I find in like being able to say, okay, this is all of who you are, and we're going to create an environment that honors all of who you are, whether it's for a kiddo. And I just threw this quote in there because I really liked it. The child supplies the power, but the parents have to do the steering. And I'll just kind of fly through these. If you want to take pictures of them so you can look at them for later, please feel free. So the biggest thing that I have seen for kiddos with ADHD and ASD is kind of just ground level, if you're just like, okay, these are the new things that we're dealing with, is consistency. So creating structures that are clearly communicated, like clear roles and expectations and consistent schedules, and like scheduling can be particularly important. So I found that visual schedules have been one of the biggest things for a lot of the families that I've worked with, because it can help kind of redirect both meltdowns and questions like, well, what are we doing? And like, part of the beauty of homeschooling is that flexibility, but then giving like some structure, and maybe it's like and adding choices in when possible. So maybe it's like, okay, like, I was this kid and I didn't deal with these particular struggles, but like, I had to do math first, because math took me the longest, and I would just avoid it, and like, it would be horrible if I didn't do math first. We tried it a couple times, it did not go well. So like, through my entire homeschooling career, I did math first. But after that, I would change it up based on the day. And even for younger kids, maybe you know, like, okay, for this kid, they love math. They can do that later. But like, if I get them, like, getting them to do any like language arts writing thing is the worst. So maybe it's like, okay, we get up, we brush our teeth, we eat breakfast, like, we run around outside for 15 minutes to get some energy out, we come back in, and we do English. And then we take a break, and then we do either this or this. And then you can kind of have that schedule, so you don't have to be kind of stuck in one way. So you still get the beauty and the flexibility of homeschooling, but then you're also providing a very specific, like, okay, when they say like, but I want to do this, it's like, okay, but what does the schedule say? And like, it helps with that routine. And then that kind of builds in those behavioral interventions. So like, providing like forced choice answers, because kids want to have power. They want to like feel like they have agency in it. And there's real beauty in that balance of, okay, like, you're still the parent, you're still in charge, but like, okay, we can give you choices in like this thing. So like, do you want this? Do you want strawberries or blueberries? Do you want carrots or celery? Like those little choices can go a long way, especially I think for the more behaviorally difficult kiddos at times, like it can help build that agency and that feeling of control over their environment. And a huge thing is praise and reward, especially when they're doing things that are really good. So like for ADHD kiddos, like what we'll tell parents, especially when it's a new diagnosis and they're just coming and they're like, okay, like why do we even do this? Like, let's say your kid cannot pay attention for longer than 30 seconds and you catch them paying attention for a minute and you go, oh my gosh, you just, and like as soon as they look up, oh my gosh, you just paid attention for 1 minute. That's huge. Like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. You worked so hard. That must have been, you put in so much effort. And like in the back of our minds, we're like, a minute is not that long, but it's an improvement. And that praise can go so much further.
I have a question.
Yes.
So when you're praising one child, mm-hmm. and then the other one, as I said,
yeah.
you have one who's on the spectrum, ADHD mm-hmm. and then ADHD. Mm-hmm. So when you praise
yeah.
one, then the older's like, well, what about me? Am I doing? How do you,
yeah.
mean, what is the best way to handle that? Because
right.
I don't want to, you know, to me, I don't think I'm not going to praise you just because I praise.
Right.
But then he gets, yeah. So how do, when there are children that
right.
they do need that affirmation.
I think, again, it depends on, like, the kid and, like, what you feel like they could comprehend. Like, if it's a kid that, like, if you talk to them alone and be like, hey, I've noticed that, like, you really notice when I praise X because, like, when he does this. And, like, I'm wondering how that's been making you feel. I think having that conversation about, because the problem isn't that for the child, isn't that you're praising them. It's like, well, like, am I good too?
Okay.
So I think when we focus on the emotion behind it rather than focusing on the action, then it gives a lot of freedom. Yeah, and it gives space to be like, and it really gets the kid what they want then, because like, my guess is he doesn't want you to say good job every time he does something. He wants to know that you're noticing him too, and he, and all, and have all of those good feelings. But what that looks like for that kiddo gets to look different. And depending on the age, I think it's totally appropriate to say like, hey, like, you know, like, this sibling like struggles in these areas, so I'm helping him. Like, and I help you in different ways. And like, how do you feel like I can help you better? Or even that conversation. So it gives space for you not. Because you're not saying, like, I'm going to treat you exactly the same. Because they're not the same. They're not. And that is, I think, one of the harder parts of homeschooling, like, that I saw both my mom and I've seen in other families, is that when there's more than one kid, like, you're being pulled in different directions at all times. So a huge part of it is also giving yourself, I think, parents giving themselves grace, being like, I can't be all things for all kids every day. And some days it's like, this kid's gonna have a bad day, and it's like, okay, like, that's where we're at. And maybe we'll have to go back and talk to these kids and be like, hey, I dropped the ball here. And that's how it is. And that sounds, I hope that doesn't sound negativistic. I like to think of it as more like being open and like giving ourselves space to be human, as our kiddos are human and will force us to continue being human. I'm realizing that we are running out of time, and I want to make sure that we have time for questions. So I am just going to rush through these. I'm not going to even really read them. So here are ideas for different parts of executive functioning. I'll start with this one. I'll just leave it up for like 5 seconds. Feel free to take a picture. I can also pop them back up once we're done, and we can take picture and have them up. This is some other ones like memory and emotions. Here are some social skill ideas. the facial expressions one that I love, like the kids hate it, but practicing in a mirror with them can be super helpful. Turn taking in games, and I think the prompting is the honestly one of the best things, especially about homeschooling, because you're in a classroom with 20 kids, the teacher can't always prompt the kid, but at home, like when there's fewer people, it's a little easier to say like, hey, I'm talking, you need to look at me. Hey, I'm talking, you need to look at me. And then eventually there'll probably be a cue, even just like a short cue that you could give to pull them in. And then the last big thing is that taking care of yourself is a huge part of taking care of your kids. This is, I think, these are both really diagnoses and kind of conceptualizations of kiddos that have a lot of strength and a lot of power, but there's a lot of hard stuff too, and it's an adaptation. And I think especially as homeschooling parents that that impact is even more. So whether that's swapping babysitting with a trusted friend so that you can either go out alone or go out with your partner, like whether it's just like mom's going outside and nobody can follow me for 5 minutes, or I'm shutting the door and you can't knock, and there are even lots of support groups for parents. And I think another big piece of care for yourself and others is knowing when outside help is what you need, whether it's for your child but also for yourself, because these are difficult things. It's not they're not bad things, but they're still hard things. So whether that's having a support space or a therapeutic space for yourself or your child to manage what's going on, because I think what I see so much from parents is, you know, we've done everything we possibly can on our own and we're just like we have nothing left. And like that's a horrible place to be for everyone. Like that's really hard. Like just like not even beyond the kiddo. Like that's just hard on parents. It's hard on a marriage. It's hard on a family. So if you notice that you're starting to get to the place, I think knowing like, okay, that's a good sign. Like I need something else. And I always just like to end on the beauty of ASD and ADHD. So these are kiddos who are oftentimes insanely creative. They have amazing, unique ways of seeing the world, unique humor, ability to hyper-focus on things that they're interested in, intelligence, fairness and justice. There's honesty. And like, there's this really beautiful, and a lot of times, understanding of like being okay with difference. Like I definitely have had kids who have done social skills group, so they're like, but why isn't it okay that I'm different? Like, why can't I just be myself? Like, why does it matter if other people think I'm weird? And like, there were still some more skills that needed to be built for that kiddo, but like, there's something really beautiful in like choosing to say like, yeah, I know I'm different, and I also have these really good things about me, so oh well. And then here's are just some really brief resources. There are so many more. So here's like just two websites that can have really good information. Some of my favorite books, the Julia Cook children's books, I really like a lot. She has ones for each kind of different area of executive functioning. My personal favorite one is about cognitive flexibility, which is like the ability to like kind of go back and forth and between things and let things change, and it's called My Day is Ruined. It's about a kid who like something goes wrong and just like loses it. And then the Instant Help series are like, they have a lot of different workbooks for different things. So we have a couple minutes left, and then lunch is at 12. So it's, I guess it's in the building right next to us, and it is provided, so you don't have to worry about that. And so we have like a couple minutes for questions, and then I'll just hang out here until 12 if there are any questions after that. Oh, yes, absolutely.
And then can you put the one back for the social skills?
Yes, absolutely. Just let me know when I can switch, and I'll switch back. Yes.
Social stories. Are those,
yes.
Appropriate for a child who's cognitively in a 2-year-old, like a 4-year-old child with autism spectrum disorder?
Yeah.
But cognitively he's about 2 years old.
I think so, especially because you can make them, because you might be telling the same social story for a long time, but we know with kiddos with ASD, is such a huge part of it is that repetition and helping them, like, they're not necessarily going to learn the social story the first time you read it, but I think...
Should you say things the same way, or should you use different phrasing? Like, my son, so I have a four-year-old.
Right.
ASD, and he actually doesn't have his right frontal lobe.
Okay.
Epilepsy.
Okay.
So he's had surgery and everything, so like he does not have
right.
that part of his brain at all.
Okay.
So he's very handsy, like on kids, he can't keep his hands off of anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like our big issue. So we did like role playing,
mm-hmm.
kind of like with his toy. I was like, what happens if someone steals your toy? And, you know, and he would, I was like, what should you say? And like worked it through that way.
Yeah.
And it seemed to help some, but like he doesn't always take it into all environments and all
mm-hmm.
like slightly different situations. Like it doesn't get kind of generalized.
Right. And I think a social story could definitely be helpful. So maybe, and I think real, like you can, it can be as like basic as you want it. So it's like, what's your kiddo's name?
Joel.
Joel. So like, it could be like, Joel goes to church, and Joel sees this, and Joel wants that. But Joel's not, doesn't do that because he knows blank. Like, it can be as, like, fundamental as you feel like is appropriate to the situation. And maybe it's like, okay, we get one situation down. And we focus on that situation, and then maybe we make a slightly different social story for the next situation, and then we keep going. But they can really be customized to the scenario, the situation, to match the needs of your family and your kiddo. Yes.
Do you have suggestions for how to transition from a preferred activity to a non-preferred activity?
Yes. Yeah, that's a huge one.
My kid will just shut down and mm-hmm. refuse to
yes.
do it. And
mm-hmm.
I can't find
Thank you.
Any kind of reinforcement, positive or negative, that will mm-hmm. get him to do his work.
Right.
It's like whatever he doesn't want to do, he just won't. And
there are a lot of pieces to that. Does he start the day with preferred activities?
Yeah, he's my early bird.
Okay.
So he wakes up before everybody else is going. And so he'll play or do what he wants to do until we're all like functional. He's better in the morning, so
okay.
I try to start
mm-hmm.
school in the morning, but even if I can transition into homeschool and we
mm-hmm.
get past that hump, it's
mm-hmm.
like as soon as we hit a part of homeschool where he actually is learning and
right.
it's a challenge, all of a sudden now we have another problem where it's like we just
So there are two parts of that. I have found that like visual timers can be really helpful. Like, okay, we're gonna start in 5 minutes, and like having like a visual, like not even just like mom's gonna tell you in 5 minutes, like having him set the timer himself. Like maybe even if it's like a kitchen egg timer or like a timer on a phone or an iPad or whatever, so it's like he's involved with it and he knows. That can be really helpful. And even if it's like, okay, there's a 15-minute one and a 10-minute one and a 5-minute one, like if he needs that countdown at first, that can be really helpful. There was another piece of that that you mentioned and that I totally blanked on. You said it was the transition. Oh, and then shutting down. So when he's calm, kind of talking about, like starting to build like a toolkit of what's going on, of that he can use when he's like starting to get overwhelmed. So like, okay, like it's getting hard, so we're shutting down. Like, okay, like I'm like, so when he's calm, building a language around that, because when he's in that state, you're right, you can't do anything. It's not there, but foot. So the skills kind of have to be built outside of that. And whether that's, you know, individually, whether that's from with support from other parents, whether that's like a lot of like child therapists involve a lot of like parent consultation, that like that's my kind of big suggestion. If you have therapy for your child, you should be involved and you should be getting that, and they can help structure kind of provide structure around, you know, okay, are we going to do like a specific targeted behavior, and we're going to offer a lot of praise around like doing the opposite of that behavior, and to try to like basically extinguish that behavior, because we know like praise is way better at getting rid of difficult behaviors than punishment is. Doesn't mean punishment isn't necessary sometimes. But there are a lot of aspects of that. But I just also want to validate that you're right. When he shuts down, like there really, it does, like you feel like there's nothing that you can do because he shut down, and like there really isn't something that you can do to crack through that besides being like, okay, I'm not going to join you in that land. Like, I see that you're struggling. We're going to take a 5-minute break. Like, and you can say, like, you can go sit over there, like, in that chair and take some deep breaths or whatever. It doesn't mean that he gets to just go run free and do what he wants. Yeah, don't let him play. Don't let him play.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what we do is if she's overwhelmed, then she can go take a minute, but she doesn't need to go do
Thank you.
She wants.
Right.
She gets whatever it is that calms her down that we know and that we talk about it when she's fine, not in the heat of
the moment. We have a calming basket. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with like little fidget hand squishy sensory, mm-hmm. like, so when he gets to that point, yeah.
Okay. No, you're good.
Go get something from the calming basket. Just because they gotta figure out, and they've gotta figure out how to calm themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's been our biggest thing. Is,
yeah, and now that we've talked about it so much outside of the moments of
yes.
Yes. Tell me, I'm getting overwhelmed.
Tell me which. That one? Okay,
they
sure.
They can tell their heart rate. That's the main thing with our son. Like, how is your heart? And I'm starting to feel hot inside my heart.
Absolutely.
Okay, we're gonna.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Counseling is a big help.
Yeah.
That's, I think, where we're at. It's like the next step. I thought homeschool would help, but now I'm finding that I'm just not.
Therapy is huge.
Therapy is yeah. Yeah, and just like the structure, because it's really just an outside voice giving you different ways to think about things, and it doesn't really mean anything about your parenting, because we all need outside voices to tell it. Be like, hey, like you notice that like one thing over there? If you like tweaked that a little bit, I wonder if it would help.
And usually that's one little thing. I'll go to the therapist, you know, because we go twice a week, and it's like, okay, yeah, we're doing that, yeah, we've done that. But there's always one little snippet that we take from, and it does make a difference. And it is good to have an outside voice.
Can you yeah. recommend, we're in Boyertown,
okay.
Can you recommend a therapist in that area? Because there's so many pieces with, you know, homeschooling Christian
right.
kids with, you know,
ADHD, mm-hmm.
something.
Right.
I'm working in Baltimore, so we do everything we can to greet her.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much.
How old is your child? He just turned 7. Have you done any OT or...
Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. I hope it was helpful.
Not really.
Thank you.
We have great OT that she's been since she was 4. So that's mm-hmm. our biggest therapeutic.
Yeah.
OT.
Yeah.
Do you have a therapy near you? They're everywhere. So
I've never heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a therapy?
And that's where we go for OT, PT, speech.
Yeah. Where is Boyertown?
Near Pottstown.
Near Pottstown, okay.
Bay.
Okay,
how close are you going to
say Hershey's there?
Hershey, because I'm sure that there has to be something in Allentown. I'm trying to think, because I did grad school out in Illinois, so like I'm much more familiar with the services there than I am at Wellspan Philhaven here. but I don't. We don't go that far north in our autism center.
Yeah, you're looking for therapy like OTP, speech, Good Shepherd in Landon. That's where we go. So, and they, I mean, they have like very big waiting lists for after school hours, but if you can do the homeschooling, you can do morning, afternoon hours, they can get you better.